Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's the 2nd of May. Good morning and welcome to Africa Link. I'm Crispin Mwakideo in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, South Sudan's government of national unity faces a myriad of challenges. Presidential spokesperson Ateni Wekateni shares one of them.
Well, there are still challenges and bumpy roads ahead. What is difficult is when the people don't control the guns and allow guns to control them.
South Africa's main political parties, the African National Congress and Democratic Alliance, are left to ponder after Julius Malema fills a 40,000 stadium with his EFF party supporters.
This is a number that ANC, according to Xmas, did not reach when they launched their own manifesto the previous week, and DA failed again.
Plus, we shall be following up on the search and rescue operation in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, after a six-story building collapsed. Don't go too far.
Top story.
We begin on a positive note with messages of congratulations from the African Union and the United Nations. The continental and global bodies have both welcomed the formation of a transitional government of national unity in South Sudan. However, on the ground, the new government faces daunting challenges, as Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
I do hereby swear by Almighty God.
That is Mr. Kiir's new cabinet taking oath of office over the weekend at State House in Juba. Formed on the basis of a regionally mediated peace deal, the cabinet will run a transitional government of national unity under the leadership of Mr. Kiir and his rebel Tanti First Vice President Riek Machar. But the unity government faces intimidating challenges, security, a battered economy and reconciliation, to name just a few. President Kiir says these challenges are huge, but united South Sudan can confront and overcome them.
The responsibility imposed on us by the agreement needs each and every one of us to contribute to the stabilization of our country.
Kiir and Machar have both pledged to work together. However, mistrust still exists between the two leaders and other various opposition political groupings that make up the transitional government. Paulino Lukudu, the Catholic Archbishop of Juba Diocese, told President Kiir and his cabinet during the swearing-in ceremony that they need to reconsider and reconcile their differences if they are to gain the trust of South Sudanese and the international community.
The way I see you in the hall here, little has changed. For 3 years, South Sudan did not function well. It is now, through you again, that South Sudan is being put on its feet to try and continue the program that was there before, but to do it better.
James Okuk, a lecturer of political science at the University of Juba, told the DW addressing the three major challenges, security, economy and reconciliation, would require the various political groupings to fix their differences.
The reconciliation is very important because it will lessen the tension and it will create the compromise which is needed in this agreement, because the agreement itself is a compromise. And that compromise will not realize its goals until people have really forgiven each other for what had happened in the past.
Okuk says the unity government also needs to speedily fix the insecurity issue that includes disarmament and reintegration of various militia groups and a silencing of gunshots across many parts in the country.
Wake Simon Wudu in Juba. Now, let's take a closer look at the challenges facing the new government of national unity in South Sudan. Many observers say the biggest threat to the implementation of the peace deal is the mistrust between the government and the former rebels. Both factions still have armed troops in Juba, something that led me to ask Ateni Wekateni, President Salva Kiir's spokesperson, how they intend to keep the guns silent.
Yeah, the first priority is for the transitional government of national unity cabinet to work on improving security situation in the country. And as the security situation improves, the economic situation will improve significantly, because these rampant killings that happen here in South Sudan is is an impediment to the coming of investors into South Sudan.
Now, even in Juba at the moment, we have these two factions, the government and the opposition, with armed forces that are heavily armed. How easy or tough is it going to be to make sure that these guns remain silent?
Well, there are still challenges and bumpy roads ahead of the, you know, implementation of peace agreement. But it is at the same time a responsibility for the parties in the transitional government of national unity to ensure that they lead their people, they lead their forces properly into a trust-building position so that the guns are controlled by the people. Because what is difficult is when the people don't control the guns and allow guns to control them.
East Africa's regional bloc, IGAD, played a very important role in setting up this unity government. Would you say that their work is now finished?
No. They have actually done a role that can be actually applauded and appreciated. But at the same time, they have also to watch from far on seeing how the parties would be implementing the peace agreement, as we also need to be guided through transitional period. So we don't want them to abandon South Sudan completely. We have now become part of East African community. We want the East African community and the IGAD as well to still to continue to supervise us from far.
There are some reports that there's still some ongoing fighting in parts of South Sudan. Who is fighting who now? Because Deputy President Riek Machar and Salva Kiir are now working together. So who is fighting who?
Well, I understand on the wake of the signing of peace agreement on the 26th of August 2015, there were a splinter group that came out and associated themselves with Machar, who were actually part of Machar during the negotiation, who said they are not going to be part of Machar and President Salva Kiir. These people are still determined, especially the group of Peter Gadet, who is still in Khartoum, are still discontented with this government. So it's not possible to rule out that there might still be some splinter group here and there who may try to cause havoc in an attempt to bring their case to the table. But the government of South Sudan has extended its hand out for any South Sudanese who is aggrieved by any situation to be able to join us in the government of national unity and make sure that, you know, we silence all guns.
South Sudan's presidential spokesperson, Ateni Wek Ateni.
Africa Link, every weekday on DW Deutsche Welle.
Fighting against time. Kenyan rescuers are still searching for survivors after a residential building collapsed on Friday. At the time of this broadcast, 20 people had been confirmed dead. 135 have been rescued, with more than 70 others still missing. President Uhuru Kenyatta, who toured the site, ordered the owner of the building, which had been declared unfit for human habitation, to be arrested. James Chimanyula has been describing to me how the search and rescue operation is proceeding.
Hopes of finding survivors are diminishing as hours tick by, because there were screams throughout the night of people trying to reach the authorities that were searching for them. But it looks like they were buried under heavy rubble that could not be reached by the people trying to excavate or dig deeper to ensure that at least they can pull out some survivors. It has been a tedious work, complicated by continued heavy rains. Never before in more than 40 years have I witnessed heavy rains falling the way they have been falling in Nairobi.
What about those who used to live in this collapsed building and were rescued? What has happened to them?
Well, they have been sent to a nearby primary school for accommodation, and the Kenya Red Cross is trying to help them. Some politicians in the area are also helping them. The government is swinging into action to ensure that they are safe and that they are helped. So it's a coordinated kind of teamwork.
President Uhuru Kenyatta has ordered the owner of the building to be brought in for questioning, or to be arrested rather. But this owner is not the only one to blame, isn't it?
I must tell you that every time we have such a calamity resulting from buildings that were constructed without permission from the authorities or with the permission from authorities to be destroyed, but because of other ways that I cannot describe here, it looks like there are many buildings. I could probably count more than 20 or so that may fall in the same category as the building that collapsed, because they have been built without permission from the government. They were marked for destruction more than 2 years ago, and they have been there. But you know, one thing should be borne in mind, that at times when calamities happen, the government swings into action, it helps the people, the whole story comes to an end, and then we forget about it.
DW correspondent James Shimanyula in Nairobi. From Kenya, let's head down to South Africa, where Julius Malema has pulled off another political surprise. While launching his Economic Freedom Fighters Party manifesto over the weekend, Malema once again reiterated how he intends to empower the black South African economically. Take a listen.
Two important cardinal pillars is the expropriation of the South Africa's land without compensation, the nationalization of mines, banks and other strategic sectors of the economy without compensation.
EFF leader Julius Malema. And as DW correspondent Tuzo Kumalo explains, Malema taunted the opposition DA party as well as President Zuma. But it was the huge number of supporters that has people talking in South Africa.
Malema's speech indeed has surprised many in some quarters. Not more about his speech, it is more about the numbers that he managed to feel about a stadium of 40,000, some estimates are saying up to 50,000 people. This is a number that ANC, according to Xmas, did not reach when they launched their own manifesto the previous week, and DA failed again. So he displayed a show of force and a show of power. But in his speech, yes, of course, he ruffled a lot of feathers and even warning the ANC to forget that it's going to defeat EFF in the coming elections.
He said that some of the two main pillars of his party is the acquisition and redistribution of land without compensation and the nationalization of mines, banks and other institutions. But how much support does these policies have in South Africa?
Unfortunately, in South Africa, the inequality is so huge. A lot of people have no land, a lot of people have no jobs, a lot of people have no economic freedom in their hands. So Malema is playing into the hands of the desperate people. One of the things that makes his party being supported more by the youth is because of those policies that are saying the wise took land by force, let's take it by force, let us not pay for it. So this is one of the pillars that makes EFF being supported here. Obviously, tapping from the desperation of people here, people with unemployment going high, people are thinking this is the party that they want in power that will take by force banks and all corporate companies so that at least they can have employment and have economic freedom. Remember, their name is Economic Freedom, and they are saying what they want to deliver to the people is that economic freedom. And it is through taking land by force and taking banks and all other international companies that they believe should be in the hands of the black South Africans.
He also dared the police commissioner or the police chief to come and arrest him after he had threatened to take over power through the barrel of a gun. But why isn't the police acting on these treason charges?
Experts have already dismissed the treason charges, saying they won't stick now because according to the definition of the treason charges, this should be committing an intentional act or unlawfully to act against the government in order to commit a crime or to harm. And experts are saying Malema has not done all that. So they are taking it as a political gimmick and something that usually happens when there are elections.
DW correspondent Tuzo Kumalo in Johannesburg. Crime Fighters, our radio drama, is up next.
Deutsche Welle, learning by ear. Listen up, shape your future.
A very warm welcome to our series, Crime Fighters, Drugs to Cure, Drugs to Kill, by Mukoma Wangugi. We're on the third episode, called At the Precipice. After 21-year-old Peter died of drug overdose, Peter's houseboy Fuma led the detectives to the bar The Lounge. Here they found a huge quantity of illegal and counterfeit medicines. It appeared that the owner of the bar was Dr. Kamkuta, the president's personal doctor. But he told the detectives they needed to talk to his brother Malinya, as he actually runs the lounge.
The old saying that an apple doesn't fall far from the tree is a lie. Here we have two apples from the same tree. One, perfectly ripe, falls, bounces into the shade and becomes Dr. Kamkuta. The other, a rotten apple, falls, rolls down the hill and becomes Malinya. Their fates are linked by the bonds of brotherhood. But it seems that whatever Kamkuta does to try and help Malinya, Malinya's rottenness still shows through. After we'd interviewed Dr. Kamkuta, Salamisha and I picked up our colleague Chokbank and went to Malinya's house.
I don't think there's anyone home.
Yeah, probably you're right.
I'll try the back.
Goodness, get down!
I kicked in the door and entered with my gun drawn, Chokbank and Salamisha behind me. A man was lying on the floor in front of a large glass window. In the glass was a small hole, more like a spider's web, where the bullet had come through. Whoever had shot him was good and dangerous.
Cover me!
I got you. Chokbank, check the window.
The window's clear.
Are you Malinya?
Yes. Please, don't kill me. I don't want to die.
We're not with them. We're detectives. We've come to ask you a few questions about the lounge.
Kalumba, press some cloth on the wound or he'll bleed to death.
Malinya, do you know who did this?
No. For God's sake, get me some help.
It's true. You don't look too good, man. Tell us the truth and we'll call you an ambulance.
Ambulance? I'll be dead long before.
Okay. We'll drive you to a hospital ourselves if you tell us what we want to know.
Take me to my brother.
He's going to die on us. If we lose him, we'll be right back where we started.
Fine. Get him to the car. We'll persuade him to talk to us later. Malinya screamed in pain all the way to the hospital. Salamisha tried to comfort him. So did Chokbank in his way. He threatened Malinya that he'd better make it, otherwise they'd meet again on the other side and it'd really make him sorry. When we finally got to the hospital, they paged Dr. Kamkuta, who came immediately to take care of his brother. That's when my phone rang. The coroner. Chokbank stayed at the hospital to question Malinya as soon as he came round, while Salamisha and I went to the morgue. It was always quite something going to see Ndau. He was unlike any other coroner I've ever seen. Very tall, muscular, always wore a suit. The smell in his workplace was so sterile, so devoid of humanity, it felt like death itself. If Kamkuta was good at saving lives, Ndau was good at dissecting death. The only thing that seemed out of character was that he liked a good laugh.
Ah, there you are, my friends. I'd like to say I've missed you, but I don't suppose my feelings are reciprocated, are they?
The less you see of me, the better, right? What is it you call me?
Huh? The devil's accountant, huh?
But it's a compliment, Ndau. It means you wield a kind of power.
True, Salamisha. Yet you don't wish to be counted by me, do you?
Well, no, not yet. What have you got for us, Ndau?
Peter was poisoned, cleverly poisoned, over a long period of time. I'd say 2 weeks, a month.
Are you going to tell us how?
Cyanide. In pill form. Cyanide packaged to look like something else and mixed in with his regular capsules. He had a heart defect. He had a prescription for Bimax and we found traces of that in his blood. But it's very rarely lethal, even when taken in large amounts. And we didn't find it in high doses. But the cyanide? Now, that's what killed him.
Hold on. Explain this again. You're saying he was poisoned slowly, over time?
You realize how easy that is? This country is awash with illegal medications. Millions of people buy them because the medications the doctors prescribe are simply too expensive.
But Peter comes from a very rich family.
Look, I'm no detective. That beats your job. The point is that whoever killed him was working with people who make knockoff meds. Someone with medical knowledge and the ability to make cyanide capsules. Someone who also had access to Peter's heart medication.
So we're looking for a cold-blooded, patient, methodical killer or killers.
And they are clever. Very clever.
How cruel. Every time Peter reached for his heart medication, he was actually killing himself.
Thanks, Doc. Good work as always. We are going to Peter's funeral this afternoon.
I wish him bon voyage. But don't thank me yet, Kalumba. I hope you realize you're dealing with some very dangerous people.
Peter's funeral was attended by the who's who of Kitagu People's Republic, all the way from President Gomobo to ministers, judges, celebrities, philanthropists, and those whose claim to fame was simply being filthy rich like Peter's parents. Killers like to attend their victims' funerals, sometimes out of perverse pleasure and satisfaction, but more often because they can't quite believe their victim is really dead. I knew my killer was here somewhere. It was a classy funeral with expensive wine and cheese, and Chokbank was taking full advantage of the catering. By the late afternoon, he was drunk and still drinking.
The Lord works in mysterious ways. He has taken Peter, and now his parents must mourn him. Surely it should be the other way around. Surely the natural way of things is for children to mourn their parents.
Yeah.
But we know that with the Lord, there are no accidents or mistakes. He has called Peter home for a reason.
If you say so, preacher.
Kalumba, we'd better go and offer our condolences. Chokbank should stay here and try to look sober.
Okay, Salamisha. Let's make ourselves visible. Maybe someone will get nervous and slip up. Chokbank.
Yes, sir.
We'll be right back, okay?
Okay. Preacher man.
Yes?
You preach a good game. Do you often go preaching at the lounge?
One must preach in the den of sin.
Ah. So Baba Peter's house is a den of sin, is it?
Look around. Look at all the powerful sinners here, shedding crocodile tears. This is the greatest den of sin.
Oh. You know who killed the boy?
You know how to get the top? You start at the bottom. The top is right here.
Oh.
But to get to him or them, you have to hit the streets, the dens of sin. What I've heard through the good Lord is that it was a healer. You know, the heathens, the non-Christians, the ones who practice African bush medicine.
Names. Why don't you give us some names?
Indeed, the Lord had been very kind. A name does come to mind.
Does the preacher really have a hot tip for the detectives? Find out next time. In the meantime, feel free to visit our website, dw.com/crimefighters, and join the discussion on Facebook. Bye for now.
And as always, before we go, a summary of our main stories. The AU and the UN have welcomed South Sudan's unity government, even as it begins the hard work of reconciling and reconstructing the nation. Kenyan rescuers are still searching for survivors from a collapsed building in Nairobi. And in other news, Germany's Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier has been visiting West Africa. You can already find more info on the German-Africa relations by visiting dw.com/Africa. For comments and suggestions on the stories you've aired, send an email to feedback dwafrica@dw.com. I'm Crispin Mwakideu. Have a wonderful week ahead.